Basically, let me see if we can trigger our memory. Some of what we had talked about was kind of what Randy was talking about. Randy had given his, this is why I'm a Christian. And we had, at the end of it, said the things that we need to do is set what, or at least understand for ourselves and for other people. If you're in a discussion with somebody about what you believe or what they believe, it's really, really easy, if you're not thinking about your own beliefs, to adopt an extreme skepticism, one that says, well, you can't really know that, or you can't really prove it. So I can set the bar so high that the other person can't meet it. That actually is trivially easy. I think any of us could do that with any set of beliefs that we want to. So it actually, in my opinion, you can do that as an intellectual exercise. But at the point where you start demanding that of somebody else before you will believe it, is hypocritical unless your actual bar for belief is that high. Or maybe another way to say it is, you probably believe things on a bar this high when it comes to what you choose to eat, how you conduct your life, what career you chose, what you think the quote-unquote right thing is in your actions, the things that you act on. But you may say, well, I'm not going to accept your moral standard unless you can prove it to here. Well, okay, to what did you prove your own moral standard that high? Did you prove your own, your own justification for why you do what you do on a daily basis on important issues? How high is your own bar? And what I'm saying is, unless you are willing to be accused of being a hypocrite or being a hypocrite, you ought not hold other people to a standard higher than that to which you hold yourself. Now, what you might do is, like Randy will tell you, that he just keeps his standard that high for his own beliefs and for other people's beliefs. Now, because Randy's not here and he doesn't mind, I'll attack his position a little bit because it's up on the board. You can say that's the case. But like I've said, maybe some folks in here heard me say it before, what you do in your life is what you say is actually almost worthless in many respects. What you do is the proof of what you believe. So I like to kind of pick on Buddhism a little bit for this one. You know, we might come in here and listen to a lecture on a Buddhist who says, I can teach you to move the world like they do in the Matrix, where you can walk through walls, where you can stop bullets in midair, where you can do all those kind of things. And I would go to that lecture. That seems interesting. You know, if you can actually do that, I'd like to do so. But if he gets up and walks out through the door, I'm going to ignore everything he says. Why? Because if he actually can walk through the wall and the world is all illusion to him, then the door and the wall are no different to him. And he ought to be able to walk out the wall with as much ease as he does the door. So the proof of whether he actually believes what he says or not is whether or not he uses the door. So that's a little bit of an extreme example. You'll hear philosophers say things like, all the world is illusion, none of this is real, you can't know. But do they step in front of a bus when it's coming down the street? That'll tell you whether they actually treat it like an illusion or not. So there's some debate that you can have about these things, but basically the point I was making was when you interact with somebody else, and really primarily yourself first, but when you want to talk to somebody else, rather than throwing out, here's why I'm a Christian, or here's why I believe what I believe, if you're asked. I think if somebody asks you the question, why are you a Christian? You shouldn't even begin to answer it until you say to them, tell me what you believe and why you believe it. And maybe they'll be a little bit wrong-footed and say, I'll be in charge for a second. I'm asking the questions here. You tell me why you're a Christian. And you have to say back, I can't tell you about belief until I understand. I can't even make an argument to you that is going to be in any way answer your question unless I know what your question really is. And your question is really based on what your own standard of belief is and what you believe. So that was really the point I was making. I think what you were saying last time, and I'm probably misquoting you, but I think what you were saying last time was maybe it's not the case that what people actually do is their standard of belief, that they can hold knowledge to a higher standard than belief. And I think I was trying to argue that belief and knowledge ought to be identical. That is to say, you should only believe in that which you know, and anything you know is something on which you will believe. Where belief in this case is defined as acting like you think that knowledge is in fact true. But if that doesn't jog your memory, then I'll just move into the next one, and if it does, you can...
Not really. So what?
All right, I'll do my thing and then jump in wherever you want. Okay, So I'm going to use, I rarely use notes in here, that will start to change, and I'm going to use notes for this one just because unrestricted, I could probably end up talking all day on this particular topic. So the question was, why am I a Christian? And then now counter to what I said, I'm not going to ask everybody here what their standard of belief is, but what I'm going to do is outline a series of thinking that in my opinion is actually what everybody else in the world really does when it comes to answering questions like this. So what I said was, you know, I on my own have a very strong desire to know truth. Some people would not articulate that their desire to know truth is as strong as I would articulate mine is, but I think at the end of the day we all really, really want to know truth. I basically don't want to be fooled. I don't want to believe or think things because they're popular. I don't want to believe them because most people believe in them. I actually don't want to believe them just because they fit some preconceived notion that I have or because that's how I was raised. That was comfortable when I was a kid, but now that I'm grown up, if my parents were wrong about what they taught, if my church was wrong about what it taught, if my school is wrong about what it taught, I want to know that. I don't want to just believe it because, hey, that was what I was comfortable and nostalgic about. I want to actually know the truth. And I want to know it for certain, where I would say it's not something that I have a bunch of doubts about, but that I know to a very good degree of certainty where I can say I'm as sure of that as I am of anything. So when I'm holding my standard up, I'm saying I'm as sure of that as I am of anything. So maybe I can doubt absolutely everything, but at least the beliefs that I hold ought to be kind of the highest standards to which I'm holding them. So I also realize that, well, if that's the case and I want to know everything that's true, that's the study of, you know, 1,000 lifetimes just to know what's going on in this universe, and that's if we got it. So I got to kind of prioritize. And I think most people, like me, don't actually want to know everything that's true because not everything's interesting to you. Do you really want to know how many kinds of walking stick insects there are? Do you want to know, you know, the number of scales on flounder? There are things out there that are probably not terribly interesting that you don't really care about. Now, there's also important knowledge out there that I do care about. So I don't mind admitting that I want to kind of scope down knowledge to quote-unquote important things. Now, I also have another problem, and that's that most of what we call knowledge, I think, is false or contains false ideas. Now, that's an interesting point, but I'll support it here. Most of what we know, I'm talking about we today, America, Western, a leading nation, maybe a hegemon if you want to think of it that way, but a place where we hold scholastic and scientific ideals up very highly, most of what we know is wrong. And that's not me saying that. I don't have it set up audio-wise to play, but this is, if you guys have ever followed this guy, Veritaserum or Veritasium, I think he pronounces it, is a popular scientific YouTube channel, and he talks about mostly scientific topics. It's like minute physics. It's like that kind of thing. And he does this presentation on is most public research wrong, published research wrong, and it's about 12 minutes long. So I won't do it here, but I would recommend you to watch it because it's a very interesting take that talks about the statistical analyses that we do on published research.
Just real quick, on the Hangouts.
Yes.
I think they're saying the mic is really quiet.
Okay. Let me see if I can't position this in a better place. We got a little bit of a white noise problem in that I've got the projector right next to it. So if that doesn't work, guys, we'll get you wired in hopefully next time by the time we pipe the mic in. So I'll speak up a little bit. Okay, thank you, Peter. The reason for that is basically the way that we do statistical analyses and we find the power of studies. And I don't want to get into a stats class here. And if you're not into stats, some of the presentation might be a little bit confusing, but at the end he wraps it up for the rest of us that aren't stats PhDs like my wife. That's a tough... Try arguing statistics with her. I have. It doesn't work. An easier way for me to make this point is the following. If you take a textbook from 200 years ago and you read it, it's laughable. You're like, I cannot believe that we used to believe this stuff. The majority of it is laughable. And that works for any 200-year period. If you're in the 1700s, A textbook from the 1500s is hilarious. If you're in the 1900s, a textbook from the 1700s is hilarious. Today, stuff from the 1800s is hilarious. What makes us think? Why would we be so arrogant as to think that in 200 years, if the world is still spinning, that people won't look back at what we have in textbooks and laugh? Not that all of it's wrong. I'm not saying it's all wrong. I'm just saying most of it's wrong. And most of it's wrong from that presentation, if you watch it. Most of it's wrong because, like, when they do published research, when they go back and try to reproduce the effects, the majority of the time they can't do it, or they get contraindicated effects. And that's not the way that we think that it should be because of peer review. Now, I'll have to refer you to the video on that one. And then if you don't like, we can argue his point if you don't like it. But I'll say, even in my wife's experience, that's been the case where there was a guy, and here's part of it, and it's not all like this, but here's part of it. She's writing in cognitive psychology about decision and judgment making. She does they do research in a paper based on this one guy named Anderson's work. They show where they're actually kind of helping Anderson out a little bit, and they show where part of what he's saying is wrong, but part of it is right, and this is the way to think of it. And when they've done the study, and the study's been checked and all that kind of stuff. The paper, when it was submitted to the leading psychology journal, was rejected. Why do you think it was rejected? One of the editors of the board, Anderson. And he wrote more than they wrote in comment back of, this is why this is wrong. And when you go back and you look at what he wrote, most of the people who reviewed that said, well, he's in error because he didn't understand the paper that he was reviewing. So what they ended up saying was, the rest of the editorial board got in communication with my wife and said, it's the case that your paper ought to be published. And she wasn't the lead. I guess she was a lead author, but she wasn't the only author on that one. And she had a doctoral supervisor on it. And he said that we're just not going to be able to drive it through the editorial board here because Anderson's on the board of people. So it's probably better if you just move it over to this other journal, it'll get published, and you don't have to publish it here. Now, academia shouldn't work that way, but that is, in fact, the way that they're human beings, and they work just like we all do. So it's not to say academia is a terrible place. It's a great place, but I would, again, watch that video, and I think you'll see I think you might agree that most published research is wrong. If not, the textbook thing should be compelling to you. So it's at least compelling to me, and at a minimum, what it does is it makes me a little bit suspicious of knowledge. And so now, basically, what I've said is, well, if I can't really trust my textbooks, and I can't really trust my, basically anything written down or knowledge that we have, not because some of it's not true, but because I don't know how to differentiate what's true and from what's false, and I'm interested in what's true. So I got to have my own method. And I think that's what we all do. I think we all have our own methods. I think some of our methods are good, some of them are bad, most of them are a mixture. But I think what we can do is say, if we're willing to only say that we know a few things, maybe there's some things we can do on it, and here's what I think. There are things that we have known for a long time, and we still know to be true. So they don't fit that. Every 200 years, we laugh at how bad they've gotten. An example would be like the Pythagorean theorem. That has been true we've known that to be true since ancient Greek times. We've known it through the medieval times. We've known it through the Renaissance. And today, we still think very, very strongly that a squared plus b squared equals c squared, and you can tell how long a triangle's legs are based on this formula. So I think that's a good one. Pythagorean theorem is a good one. If you plant wheat, you're going to get wheat back, assuming that you water it and it has sunlight and that kind of stuff. We've known that for thousands of years. It's still the truth today. Maybe the last kind of class of things, or another class of things, is if you tell your wife, honey, that bearskin / rug / dress makes you look fat, that has never once in the history of mankind elicited a positive reaction. So that is on the side of dumb and not smart, and we have known that for years. So, I mean, obviously a little tongue-in-cheek there, but there are things that we know are ancient knowledge, or maybe just older knowledge, that have borne the test of time. And I think that gives you a little bit more confidence in other things. So I came up with what I think is really the way that most of us decide whether we have a high confidence in knowledge or not. One is, I think it's sufficiently old. And that may be just a few years, it may be tens of years, it may be hundreds of years. But isn't it the case, here's my example of it. Here are a couple of examples of it. In the 70s, if anybody remembers this one, in the 70s, what was the climate threat? We were going to have another ice age, right? And in the 80s and 90s, what was the climate threat? global warming. Ozone layer, hole in the ozone layer, global warming, ice caps are melting. What is it today?
Climate change.
You go either way, and it still works. So if we finally figured it out, we just say, it's going to change. Now, you could be wrong, but we know that it always does change. But you can't be wrong if you're going to say it's going to change, especially if you're willing to measure very, very closely. So climate change it is. So you may also remember in Time magazine, I remember this very clearly, published a front page that had two eggs, sunny side up, and a piece of bacon, and it basically said cholesterol is the worst thing for you and it will kill you. That was maybe 15 years ago. What's the conventional wisdom today?
Sugar.
It's got nothing to do with fat now, almost nothing to do with fat now. It's all about sugar. Sugar is what's killing us. Sugar is what's tearing up our arteries. It's what makes people overweight, causes health problems of various types, et cetera. So in some ways, you can, if you don't like the health guidance you're getting this week, wait till next week. Somebody will publish something different. But something that you can look at kind of over the long run of, well, we know certain things about eating is like eating wheat is going to be more healthy unless you have an intolerance to wheat. Than eating sand. We figured that much out, right? So there's some things that we can say relatively reliably there. Okay. So I said, one, it's got to be kind of old. And two, I think it has to be verifiable. I'm not crazy about taking other people's words on stuff. And I actually, the time that this really hit for me was in the physics realm, when I learned that the Bohr-Rutherford model of the atom, a.k.a. the one that you learned in junior high and high school, is false, like demonstrably false, like doesn't work. Magnus is like, you got to be kidding me. No, I'm serious, man. It does not work. The Bohr-Rutherford model of the atom, of proton, neutron, electron, you know, balls in there like planets with orbiting planet electron, false. Doesn't work. Doesn't work in any world, and we don't think it works that way. Then you get to college physics, and they explain that it happens in shells and that it's a kind of a probability distribution, and it turns out that's false as well. And when you get to your PhD level, they'll say, here's how we model it, but we've actually got no idea how it works, but this is what the math suggests. And here are 14 different interpretations of what that math may actually mean, and we got no idea which one it is. They're empirically equivalent, but here's my pet theory. That's how it goes at the PhD level. So at that point, I was like, hang on a second. If we don't know what atoms are, that's the basics of chemistry. It's the basics of a whole bunch of other stuff. How do I know anything? And that was a brief night for me of, do I know anything at all kind of thing. And I came to the conclusion that I do know a few things, or I'm happy to say that I know a few things. So I want it to be verifiable. And I think verifiable happens in two ways. One is the normal thing that we mean in a scientific society of like, I can take this to a lab and test it. But not everything can be tested in a lab. So other verifiable, like you can't test that George Washington was the president. So maybe that's verifiable by historical records, or it's verifiable by laboratory empirical test, or it's verifiable by your own experience. Hey, this is a great park to go to. You're going to love it. Take your kids there. I go to the park. I hate it. I'll never take my kids there. Proven that was a false bit of knowledge by experiencing it myself or something like that. That happens for me at Six Flags. I love Disney World. Go to Disney World, you'll love it. I hate Disney World. It drives me nuts. I don't know why. Just something that never understood why I don't like. Well, I do understand it. I like to be in control. I like to fly an airplane. I don't like to be flown around on something that I don't control, and I'm not really sure who the engineer was that built the trestle underneath it. Okay, so it's got to be old, it's got to be verifiable in some meaningful way, and ultimately it has to, and this is something I think almost everybody forgets, it has to be philosophically and logically consistent with other stuff that you know. It's no good knowing one thing about science and another thing about religion and another thing about your personal habits. If all of them are philosophically inconsistent and you know that, then you know that you're living a lie somewhere. Most people just might say, well, it doesn't bother me, I'm happy to drive on. Well, I'm not happy to drive on. I want to believe true things, and I want them to all fit together into one coherent piece. And that's what philosophical or logical consistency does for you. And you might hear people say things like, logic is old, that's Aristotelian stuff, etc. So, you don't have to do that. The world is different than that. The math shows us it's different than that. And if you say to them something like, well, I don't believe that what you say is true because these tables are round. And they're going to say back to you, what do you mean? I'll be like, well, you're saying it doesn't have to be logical. I'm telling you that round tables are support for my position. And they'll say, how's that possibly support or evidence for your position? I'll say, so it sounds like you do want me to reason logically. It sounds like you do want me to imply cause and effect. You do want me to give you reasons for what it is that you believe. So is it Logic doesn't work, or is it logic does work? So that position defeats itself really quickly. So now I have at least a method. I actually think that most of us use that method, whether we admit it or not. And now I'll say this. I'm selfish. And the truth I care about can basically be boiled down to two things. I want to be happy, and I want to be happy for as long as I possibly can. Now, that doesn't sound like a really noble set of truths to pursue, does it? But let's be honest, if we're being selfish, that's basically what we're interested in. We're interested in our own happiness a lot. The ancient Greeks knew this. When they argued about the things that we ought to do, when they argued for being noble, part of their justification was being noble and living virtuously will also make you happy. And the people who lived, even the Epicureans, weren't hedonist, like, just do whatever feels good for you the next second. They said acting in virtue is part of what will make you feel good, but that's ultimately pursue that because you feel good, not because it's noble. So at the end of the day, I think that we might as well admit that we're at least half selfish and that we want to be happy and that honestly we would rather live forever and be happy or live for a long time and be happy than be happy for a short time. I think that's relatively obvious. Okay. And now I've got another problem, though, because for me, being happy also means that I need to know the truth about things, because not knowing the truth about things makes me unhappy, at least about important things. A part of the, if anybody saw that first Matrix movie, didn't walk out with a headache, congratulations, but if you remember the guy, I think, I can't remember his name in the movie, it may have been Cypher, but the guy that is making the deal to betray the team, he's having a dinner and a steak in a nice restaurant with Agent Smith, and he basically says, put me back in the Matrix, I don't want to remember anything, ignorance is bliss, is what he's figured out. That was never compelling to me. I could never go back into something saying I bought off on an illusion and that I would be happy. That doesn't make sense to me, so I never really felt that his villainy was properly motivated. Not that I'm here to do film critique. Okay. So basically, I wanted to start with a few things to get rid of the ultimate skeptic part. These are all debatable. For those who are interested in philosophy, I'll zip through this. For those that aren't, take a pause for 10 seconds. But basically, I believe that I exist. I kind of like Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. I would shorten it to, if I can say I X, where X means think, X means feel, X means sense, X means do or whatever, there's at least an I there. And although people have argued against that, I think that it's a little bit silly to do so. I'm willing to accept that I exist. I'm also willing to. It seems to me that I can be happy or I can be not happy. So the question of being happy is a good one. I also sense other things exist. Hello, other things that I sense exist out there. And it seems rational to me to think these things I sense exist unless I have a reason to believe otherwise. So I don't think that you're an illusion unless I've got a reason to believe you're an illusion. I don't mind treating this at face value. I also buy off, for those that are interested in the very particulars of it, I buy off on Plantinga's epistemology here of properly basic beliefs. I think this is a rational belief to hold unless you've got a defeater for that belief. So for that reason, I say welcome to solid ground, rather than just ignoring you and pretending that you're figments in my imagination. If you are, you're my best proof that you're not a figment of my imagination. So now at least I can start thinking about what makes me happy and how long I can be happy. So because I said it's important to know truth, I've noticed that there are some things in the world that seem to influence my happiness. I'm happier when I eat ice cream versus eating sand. That makes me happier. I'm happier when it's 72 degrees than when it's negative 20 degrees. As the Marines will tell you, I go completely internal when it gets cold, and the rest of my platoon doesn't exist, and I just want to get warm and eat something. I also think I'll live longer if I don't wander into traffic. So these are some ways that the external world can impact my happiness, or at least it seems so to me. Yes, sir?
Couldn't you believe in a lie and... You could say that makes me happy.
Yes, if you don't know it's a lie. Yeah, the question was, can't you believe in a lie if that lie makes you happy? Right? That is to say, you know, I kind of know this isn't true, but I'm going to act like it's true because it does make me happy. It not maybe for other people, but not for me. If I know that what I'm living is a lie, that decreases my happiness. So maybe I should say this. Maybe you can be happy, but I want to be as happy as possible. And so what I would rather do is, if I can find truth that makes me happy, then I feel like that might allow me to be maximally happy because I don't have this foundation of like, I know, I mean, it makes me happy, but I know it's not true. So maybe it does matter whether I can find truth that makes me happy, or if the only thing that's going to make me happy is a lie and truth just makes me miserable, okay, maybe, then I'll go believe in a lie. So that's a good point. But I think you can find truth that makes you happy.
I think we all do that every day, right? When we says, okay, God says I should do this,
yep,
but I'm going to go do this, right? For those who accept Christianity as true,
yep,
we're saying, God tells me what I'm supposed to do and what's going to make me happy.
Yes.
And yet, I abandon that truth. I buy into a lie, whether it be for a moment or for whatever. I'm going to turn my back on God and do this sin, and I'm going to buy into this lie because there's short-term gratification. So may not be long-term gratification.
Hold this in your mind because I'm going to talk exactly about this. What a terrific transition to what I'm about to talk about. Okay, so in a second. So it seems, by the way, when it comes to happiness, that in general, I want to divide it up into two major sets of ideas. One is basically that there is no God, and you kind of do the things that make you happy, and you're going to have to kind of set them yourself, or the society's going to have to set them. That's one way of doing it. And the other way is that there's some religious system that tells you how to be happy, and compliance with that one will either make you happy, and that's true or not. So there's two kind of propositions for truth, major ones out there. When you look worldwide over there, almost all of mankind believes in some sort of God or something like that. So we've at least got to, I at least want to consider it as a possibility since there are several billion people that think that that's the right answer. I might as well look at it. I got to define happiness. Now, I think I won't take too much time doing so because I think sufficiently intuitive that we kind of almost automatically seek it in many cases. But basically, to your point, I'm not really interested in the short-term happiness that maybe I can glean from believing in a lie, something that's true in the short term. I'm talking about happiness that we might also characterize as joy or happiness that doesn't dissipate over time. I'm talking about maximal happiness. I want to be as happy as I can possibly be, and that's how I'm going to do my search. So I actually want to start with kind of an atheistic idea of saying, let's look at atheism first. Why? Well, first, if it's true, it allows me to parse away a whole bunch of belief systems like right off the bat. So that seems to be a good thing to do. And second, there's a lot of smart people around today that claim to be atheists, so maybe they're onto something, and maybe that's what I'll test that one first. So let's test that one first, and maybe it'll save us some time if it turns out to be true. Now, what are the kinds of things that I got my three criteria for evaluation? What are the kinds of things that I'm interested in? I'm going to run through this very, very fast. I don't intend to argue this one because I'm just telling you why it's convincing to me. Talking about these points is what we can do as soon as I'm done or into the next week or whatever else. But so forgive me for some rapid fire, but I'm going to give you my arguments here. I'm actually interested in the origin of the universe because it seems that this universe exists. That's part of what I need to know. The origin of me because I know that I exist, and if my origin might have something important to say. If you don't think so, explain to me why 23andMe is making millions and millions of dollars. Explain why people go back and look for their armorial crests and where their family came from and all that kind of stuff. I also want to know what makes us happy, exactly the question you asked, because this is the core of my inquiry. I want to know how I can live as long as possible, because that's another core inquiry of mine. And I want to know the origin of moral intuitions. Why? Because these are actually, when it comes to intuitions, my strongest intuitions. I do think that things are right and wrong. I get really bent out of shape when things are done wrong to me, at any rate, what I think is wrong to me. And I also get bent out of shape when they're done to other people, and apparently have since I was a little kid and it was a problem in school for me. A problem. The teachers thought it was a problem. I thought it was fine. So I think those are kind of the major things that I wanted to test these couple systems with. So I went to the atheistic versions of these, and I realize that I'm putting a lot in this in a single umbrella, but here it is. Origin of the universe. There's a couple of options. There's an eternal universe or cyclical universe. So I apply my tests. Is it time-tested? Yes, the idea of an eternal universe is a tolerably ancient idea, so it passes that test. People have thought that for a long time. Is it verified by experience? Well, no, it's not. For 100 years at least, we have now thought that the universe had a beginning and that all the scientific evidence, when I say all, I'm quoting Stephen Hawking there, who says all the evidence for modern physics and cosmology that we have is for a universe that has a beginning. And we also agree in the entire community of modern science that all cyclical models for the universe fail. So the idea of an eternal universe doesn't seem to be verifiable by experience. In fact, our last century of scientific experience seems to contraindicate it. Now, maybe that's too short, but at least that's the data that we have. Is it philosophically consistent? This was really the killer for me, because the idea of an eternal past is actually logically inconsistent with the present ever having arrived. For more on that, see Hilbert's Hotel and some internet or SCP discussion on that one. What about a self-caused spontaneous universe, one that arises spontaneously out of nothing? Is it time-tested? That one actually doesn't seem to have much ancient root to it. It seems to kind of be a new idea, so maybe it doesn't pass that one. Is it verified by experience? In my opinion, not at all. It violates the number one rule of science, which is that there are causal relationships between things. There's no point in looking for an explanation of anything scientifically if you don't think that things cause things to happen and that everything that happens has a cause somewhere. It's just an axiom of science, and to not believe that is very, very unscientific, in my opinion, and I want to be scientific. So is it philosophically consistent? No, it's self-contradictory. In order for something to cause itself to exist, it has to exist. If it has to exist in order to cause anything, it already exists, in which case it can't have not existed and then caused itself to exist. So I would use the word silly. So I got to throw that one out. Well, what about the origin of men men and women? Is it time-tested? Yeah, actually, the idea of evolution is an ancient idea that goes back even to the Greeks. The mechanism that we talk about it today is modern, so maybe that works. Let's think about that one. Is it verified by experience? Now, I'm a decent believer in math. I want to attack it at some levels, but I also believe things like the Pythagorean theorem turn out to be true over a lot of period of time. So I look at things mathematically. When you run the math on evolution, it gets funny quickly, and I will tell you why. A single-celled organism's got about 4,000 proteins in it, somewhere in that neighborhood. That's how many proteins you need in order to build the first single-celled organism out there, or a single-celled organism that we see today. Simple ones. They are the chain length of the average protein chain in amino acids. So how many amino acid building blocks does it take to make the average link protein? It is somewhere between 200 and 300. Some of them in the human body are 33,000 plus long, but the average length is somewhere around 300, even for those simple molecules. So let's say that we're only trying to make one that's 150 amino acids long. This is half the length of one of the 4,000 proteins you need in order to make the simplest possible life on Earth. Okay? One of 4,000, and we're going to make it half as long as it needs to be, 150 amino acids long. Now let's take the entire Earth and clean it off and fill it full of not a hydrothermal vents or primordial soup or anything like that. Let's fill the oceans and the land all the way up, the entire surface of the Earth, 10,000 feet high, with just the amino acids that we need for life. Just those 20 amino acids, it's nothing but those, and it's 10,000 feet deep covering the entire surface of the Earth. Now let's have them combine together, not one or two at a time. Let's have them do it truly in parallel. Every combination, 150 amino acid long chain, snaps instantly into a configuration. And then we look at it to see if that's the right configuration. When I say the right configuration, it needs to be one of the proteins that we're looking for, one of those 4,000. If we then turn around and say, how frequently are we going to let that happen? Are they going to kind of move together and click together once every couple hours, once every minute? Let's do it 1,000,000 times a second. 1,000,000 times every second, 150 amino acid chain is going to form as many times as there are that many amino acids the entire Earth covered 10,000 feet deep in it. That's how. So hopefully you're getting the idea. This is ridiculous. There is no possible way that this could ever have possibly happened. It's just too much. Yet that's what we're going to grant. And it's going to happen not for the amount of time that we think such a soup might have existed. We're going to run it all the way back to as old as we think the Earth might be, 4.6 billion years old. So from the second that the Earth even existed, it's 10,000 feet deep in these amino acids. They're forming 1,000,000 times a second the entire time. And we're just, all we got to do is get it right once.
So, how did the atheists, how did they
Well, let me get finished with the math, and I'll answer your question. The question is going to be, how do the atheist explain that this happens? Because obviously I'm not an atheist, is the point he's getting at here. So the math is basically this. We know the possibility space of how many functional proteins there are for how many possible combinations are for 150 amino acids long, and it's 1 in 10 to the 77th. This is published in the Journal of Molecular Biology, and I'll give you the reference for those that are interested. But it's 1 in 10 to the 77th. So basically, you've got 10 to the 45th units because a protein in that form about that length is 2 nanometers in volume, so that's how many 2 nanometer cubes there are, and that much of the Earth is 10 to the 45th of those. That's a really big number. That's 1 followed by 45 zeros. That's a lot. Or 10 to the 17th seconds since the Earth began, possibly, if it's 4.7 billion years old. That gives you 2, and you're doing it a million times a second. That's 10 to the once every 10 to the negative 6 seconds. That gives you 10 to the 45th different sets of amino acids shots at forming this one. And they have 10 to the 23rd attempts. I'm sorry, 10 to the 23rd attempts and 10 to the 45th sections in which we're making those attempts. When you add those up, you get 10 to the 68th. 10 to the 68th is a billion times less than 10 to the 77th. So let me unpack that for you. If you fill the Earth this as deep as I just said, you have them clicking together a million times a second, every single one of them everywhere, sent for 4.7 billion years old, your chance of getting 150 amino acid long protein is 1 in a billion. You have to do that 4,000 more times just to get the proteins to build one cell. My answer to your question is the atheists don't do the math. Now, what you will see is mathematical models that say things like, and I don't mean to get it, I'll just answer your question quickly here and we can expand on it later in the interest of time. They'll do dampening models where basically what they say is when that 150 amino acid chain clicks, if it's not right, it doesn't get rejected. If 2 of it amino acids are in the right order, that gets preserved. And then the rest of it randomizes, and then when one of these out here gets in the right order, that gets preserved. The problem with that is none of those are actually functional proteins. So that mathematical model is completely unjustified. So the bottom line is you have to buy off on math. Most people don't bother doing the math. Point one. Point two, they do, the ones that do the math do so with a engine in there that does not exist in real life. Now, I have my own theory for why that is. I'm open to it, by the way. I don't care whether evolution occurred, because like Skyler believes that evolution did in fact happen, that God just kind of kicked it off at the beginning. I don't have a problem with that either. I think you can fit that into Genesis. It doesn't bother me. Remember the amount of truths I'm looking for? They're basically down to what makes me happy. And I'm perfectly happy thinking that. So I don't care. But the bottom line is the math just simply don't support that. So that's why I don't believe it. Is it philosophically consistent? Well, here's another problem. Scientists, including me, I like to think of myself as a scientist on occasion. If our rational faculties arose by random chance, then the probability that they are reliable is very, very low. I mean, imagine if somebody said to you, this computer was not something that designed, but it was a product of random chance. Do you trust what it kicks out? The answer is probably going to be no, not without a lot of testing. So ultimately, we don't have a really good reason. You can see the evolutionary argument against naturalism. We can fight that one out later, too. But evolutionary argument against naturalism, the EEAN, it basically makes the point of we shouldn't even be able to trust our thinking if that's the way that our thinking arose. And that means that it's not, in my opinion, philosophically consistent. So I got a math problem and I got a philosophy problem with that one. So, okay, well, here we go. What about what makes us happy? Well, pursuit of pleasure is kind of what's indicated if there is no kind of rules out there that somebody's making. Is that time-tested? Yes, absolutely. It goes back to ancient times, no problem. Is it verified by experience? Actually, no. When you take the survey data, now this is relatively new-ish data, but when you take survey data, religious people are always happier than non-religious people. So if what I'm actually interested in is being happy, now maybe they bought off in a lie. I've got to be careful about that one. But if you're happier being religious, now you're basically maybe back to Pascal's wager. But at least if I think, and one kind of axiom I take is, me knowing the truth is going to make me happy, even if that truth is uncomfortable. I'd rather know uncomfortable truth than comfortable lies.
You see that as a properly basic belief. You count that as a properly basic belief.
When you say that, you mean that axiom I just stated?
Yes.
Yes. I think that
truth is more important than happiness.
that truth, for me, truth and happiness are fundamentally linked. I cannot be happy if what I think that in knowledge, if I think that knowledge is not true.
So doesn't that personally drives you? You have to be aware that you have an intrinsic motivation,
yes,
towards a truth that makes you happy. A truth that makes you happy.
Not necessarily. I have an intrinsic motivation towards truth. Yeah, I hope that it makes me happy, because what I just said was I would rather have truth that makes me unhappy, because at the bottom I'd rather be happy knowing that at least I know the truth. Maybe another way to say it is, in the Matrix world, which was appeared to be a nicer world, the world of in the Matrix or this crappy world where they're living underground in the caves. It's nicer to live in the Matrix world, but if I knew the Matrix world existed, I wouldn't want to participate in it. I'd actually rather live in the cave and know truth than be stuck in a world that I know is a lie.
Right. I think you're saying that you can't be happy living a lie, living something you know is not true.
That's right. That's maybe a better way to say it. I don't mean for that point to be too... It need not be axiomatically true in order for me to continue this test. All I mean to say is, if I end up with two sets of truths, one which is a lie, and I know it's a lie, but it makes me happy, and the other one is a truth, but I know it's true, and it makes me way, way less happy, now I've got a conundrum of which happiness do I pursue.
Right, but if you were looking at two competing sets of truths,
yep,
doing their quotes, and I go, one of these validates my happy, one of these is makes me happy, makes me content, and validates a lot of the efforts of my life, and the other one does not, and I'm trying to weigh these truths, you will have a tendency, as human nature, you will have a tendency to go towards the one that makes you happy.
Okay.
I think that is a pitfall that you need to be aware of.
Sure thing. I mean, we're observer bias the whole time, but you know, without, let's just say it very quickly, there are only really four outcomes here of possibilities. It's true, it makes me happy. It's true, it makes me sad. It's false, it makes me happy. It's false, it makes me sad. We've got to be willing to entertain them all. But it is the case that if it's true and it makes me happy, that's what we hope for. Right? You're going to hope for that, because knowing that something is true is part of what makes you happy. Okay, so yeah, let's identify the bias and let's keep it out there. But it's also the case that just because it's something that, let's say you're biased in that direction, just because it fits your bias doesn't mean that it's false. You just have to do it in a blind way, right? Just because it fits your bias doesn't mean it's... Let's say that I really, really want to prove that this drug right here cures cancer. So because if it does, I'm going to be rich. I invented it. Okay, well, let's do the tests. What's the right way to do it? You do double-blind tests and you have somebody else do it. Okay. Double-blind test, I had somebody else do it. World Happiness Survey is doing this survey. I'm not the one looking at religious people and saying it makes them happy. A bunch of secularists are the ones who are looking at religious people and saying that they're happier than non-religious people. So I'm not doing the test. I don't have to worry about it. In fact, it contraindicates what the people who are doing the test actually want to prove, which is that the test is being done by the UN, not exactly a bastion of religious fundamentalism and viewpoint. So more on that one later. I know it's not being done by the UN. It's being done by people who published the report to the UN, et cetera. Steve.
I'm accused of... What is true is not making you happy. It's your belief that's true.
Yeah, so what is Stephen saying? It's not what's true that's making me happy. It's my belief that it's true that makes me happy. So remember, I'm talking about belief and knowledge, where belief is me acting in knowledge. So maybe I want to change that for the purposes of this to saying what I know to be true, or what I think that I know to be true. Well, that is the case, but that's my problem. The problem I'm trying to figure out is, what do I know? And so I think that it's something to keep in mind, but that's what I'm trying to do. Okay, so I'll rip through this really quickly because I've taken too much time. Pursuit of pleasure, is it verified by experience? I just talked about that. Is it philosophically consistent? Well, I would say no, because while you're pursuing your own pleasure, makes sense if there is no higher authority. People who act against their own pleasure by living by altruistic values report being happier than those who live only for themselves. So they might say, these are the things that I ought to do, but they don't act that way. Even people who believe in this system act in ways that are inconsistent with their own stated beliefs. Atheists who ought to say there are no rules out there still are awfully stringent about a set of rules that they don't believe in, that they think are subjective or a social contract or whatever else, oftentimes even when nobody's watching. That is just not a, it's not a logically consistent way to act. And I'm not saying that because people act that way, it's therefore invalid. I'm just saying I watch the practitioners of it, and they're self-inconsistent. So it doesn't, I'm not exactly super motivated to go try it myself in much depth. How about how we can live longer? Is it time-tested? Well, that varies week by week. Is it verified by the science? Depends on what month it is and which magazine you're reading. Is it philosophically consistent? Sure. I mean, up to 100 years or so. If I make it to 100 years old, I've done 20 years, 30 years better than I probably should have, or at least my family should have. Heck, if I make it past 55, I'll be beating some of my great-grandparents. How about origin of moral intuitions? This is on atheism. I sense, by the way, why? I sense more strongly than anything else that I know, that torturing a four-year-old girl to death for fun is wrong, really wrong, even if the society in which it's being done, there's nobody else on the planet exists except for that society, and they don't think it's wrong, I still think that it would be wrong. That would be an objective moral truth. So I think objective moral truths exist. And I feel that intuition very strongly. I recognize it's an intuition, it's a starting axiom, but it's so powerful to me that I want to say I know that better than I know almost anything else. Is it time-tested? Well, subjective and objective moral values have been a paradox since ancient times. So we haven't really known where this would come from on this viewpoint. Is it verified by experience? Well, there's no scientific basis for objective morality. There just can't be. It's a social contract, or it's group genetic preservation, or it's a subjective feeling, but it's not objective. Is it philosophically consistent? I don't think so. I think objective morality, which I sense is out there very strongly, requires an object to ground it. And there isn't even a candidate object on atheism. So, because none of these morals are necessarily true. They don't have to be the way that they are. So you can't derive them logically alone. You have to have something on which to bound. More discussion later for those that are interested, but that's convincing to me. So now I turn to religions, and I'll try to do this in 5 minutes, sort through however many thousands of religions there are out there. How do you sort through that many? How do I narrow them down? Well, fortunately, because of our look at atheism, we've got a tool that we can use to very quickly parse them down. And it was the one that I talked about. Anything that I didn't really talk about it much, but anything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Well, if that cause is, the universe is temporal, it's spatial, it's material and energy, that cause, the thing that caused it, since those things didn't exist until that cause brought them into being, the cause has to be eternal or atemporal, immaterial, arguably personal, since if it existed eternally and it's the cause, the cause existed eternally, the effect would exist eternally too, unless that cause can trigger on and off. And the triggering on and off, to me, sounds like a choice. That cause could choose to start or not start. I only know two classes of objects that can be kind of real, or what philosophers call concrete and immaterial: abstract objects and minds. And abstract objects don't cause anything to happen. Nobody thinks that a cube causes things to happen, or that an idea of an apple causes something to happen. That is, it is only minds that cause things to happen, at least possibly. So it seems to me that it's plausibly a mind. So... in addition, I know we don't. I also note this: we didn't have to exist. I don't have to exist, it seems to me. And Herr Leibniz has argued that anything that exists has a cause of its existence, or an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in some external cause. So the ultimate cause of the universe must be a necessary cause in order to terminate this causal chain back all the way. So, in my opinion, we can plausibly deduce that the cause of the universe is timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal mind that happens to be a necessary being. So I actually think that you can get that just from the cosmology. And if that's the case, that actually strips away every religion out there except for the great monotheistic religions. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, maybe Zoroastrianism, ones like that. Although Zoroastrianism has the devil and God kind of existing eternally the whole time, so it's not really, doesn't actually fit that. But it's at least a candidate one should look at. Now, is there anything that you can look at to quickly differentiate between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam? My opinion, not a terribly popular one all the time, my opinion is they're really the same. They're all thinking about the same God. They just say very different things about it. Christianity is basically just Judaism that says this particular person is a divine person, and then they're the son of God, and they're... But it's the Messiah that was promised in Judaism. So they're just, it's another form of Judaism, really, you could think of. Or Judaism is another form of Christianity, depending on which side you want to stand on. Islam, if you know it really well, is really just hey, the Jews and the Christians are talking about the right God, but they're doing it the wrong way, and here's us correcting it. So it's really talking about the same God, but theirs boils down also to all three religions hinge, in my opinion, their critiques of each other often hinge on one thing. Who is Jesus? He was either a rabbi, who was a little bit off base and got killed. He was the divine son of God, and also got killed and rose from the dead. Or he was a great prophet, but was not the divine son of God. So what we have to say about Jesus can actually differentiate which of those three religions is either true or that none of them are true. Okay, well, that's great. We can literally look to one point to differentiate this for us. So I can evaluate Christianity as a shortcut to treating theism to see if that versus atheism is a good way to think. So here's the quick rip through there. Origin of the universe, origin of men, etc., you know this all. Origin of the universe, God created the universe. Time-tested, yes, this idea goes back to ancient times. Verified by experience, I gave you the cosmological argument, literally all the all the evidence of modern science, according to Hawking. The universe began to exist and has a cause, so that seems to fit. Is it philosophically consistent? Yes, if you have an uncaused necessary being that's omnipotent and all these other things, it matches teleological arguments, it matches ontological arguments, and it matches the cosmological arguments. So you got a big philosophical consistency amongst all these arguments that seem to be derivative of good scientific evidence and good logical deductive reasoning. So far, seems philosophically consistent. How about the origin of men? God created man would be the story here. Ancient idea, yes. Verified by experience. I showed you the math. The math, to me, is very subjective that men, if we say something like this, man arose either by chance or by design. Necessity doesn't seem to be one of the things it could be, by chance or design. And we looked at how likely it is that chance could have explained that man arose. And by the way, that was one-celled organism. When you do the math on men, I won't even put the numbers up for you because they're ridiculous. They're beyond my comprehension. They're beyond anybody's comprehension. But we're talking like 10 to the 120th to the 300th power. That kind of number can't even be thought about. That's not Christians saying that. Those are atheistic physicists when they do the calculations. Those are the kind of numbers they come up with. Okay, so if I have a God that already exists, apparently, or at least is a real candidate, philosophically consistent candidate, versus this math that is impossible, it seems to me that this is a better choice than this one, just from a probabilistic standpoint. Is it philosophically consistent? Yeah, I talked about that. There's no reason to doubt that this same God that created the earth could create man. That seems trivial to me, or created the universe. Okay, how about what makes us happy? This is kind of an interesting differentiator. We've alluded to it a little bit before. Is it time-tested? Yeah, there's ancient tradition that talks about this. Is it verified by experience? When I do the data of my own personal life, and I say when I follow the quote-unquote biblical wisdom, which some of it's pretty counterintuitive, when I follow that biblical wisdom, I actually ended up happier and happier in the long run than when I kind of quote-unquote rebelled against it or did something that wasn't like that. So I actually went out and said, I know the biblical wisdom says do things for the kingdom, but I know that if I'm both as successful as I want to be in my career and I happen to be working for the kingdom, that I'll actually be happier in the long run. So I did that. And I went and got, in my opinion, if not on the actual total top of the pile, so close to the top of the pile in the stuff that I was doing for the military that it would be hard to be to think that that wasn't a successful career. And at 32 years old, I was there. And I looked around and I was like, this did not make me happy at all. Because what I found out was I had bought off on a lie. Some of the lie I'd lied to myself. I'm wrapping myself in the flag and saying, I want to do this because I want to be service to my country and all this other kind of stuff. No, I didn't. I joined the special operations kind of world because I wanted to be a ninja and I wanted people to look up to me. And I realized I was lying to myself, and that didn't make me happy. So ultimately, I ended up doing stuff that if I'd have looked at it, I want to go put on all my ninja gear and go hit targets that are existential threats to the United States. Or this weekend, and be back for tea and medals, because it's that easy nowadays. Or I want to go and help Bob Scholl load luggage on the bus for summer camp. Which of those two do I want to do? Now, I want to do the second, because it actually made me happier in the long run. That shouldn't make much sense, given kind of the way that we normally think about things, but that's actually what made me the happiest in the long run.
But didn't you have to go through that journey to discover that?
But it's loading
luggage first.
That's my point, though. Going through that journey is the testing, some of it. Now, keeping in mind Skyler's warning of, don't, if you're looking for truth and happiness together, but that wasn't what I wanted to do. What I wanted was successful career and successful contribution to the kingdom, making me optimally happy. It turns out, in my experience, that was false. So that was counter to what I thought the hypothesis should have been.
So there's some people who, at think they say something like we forge our own destiny. I think when someone asked Richard Dawkins about what is your purpose in life, he said something like we just sort of something about forging our own.
Well, he does talk about how do you choose a purpose, and he says we forge our own destiny. But if you ask him what he is, he says he's a machine for replicating and propagating DNA. So if he's talking about, let's say we do forge our own destiny, but it is the case that some of those destinies we forge will make us happy and some don't. So if this is the different people that are forging their own destinies and you're measuring their happiness, this guy right here wins because he was the most happy. It's like somebody asks a world champion surfer, who's the best surfer in the world, the lady surfer? And she instantly says, whoever's having the most fun. Because she recognizes that it's better to be happy than to be the world champion. What if the world champion's this happy? But this person's not a world champ, but they're stoked when they surf. Who's the better surfer? She says this one is. I buy that. That makes sense to me because people generally want to be the world champion because they think that's what will make them happy. Well, it turns out they were wrong about what makes them the most happy. So I'm with you. You can forge your own destiny. But what I'm saying is I tried to forge a couple of different destinies, and what turned out was when I forged things according to biblical principles, I actually turned out to be happier than when I forged them according to what I thought were going to be the better ones. And I apologize. Let me rip through the list of these. I'm almost done. World verified by experience about what makes us happy. World Happiness Survey. The top 20 countries in the world, go look at what they are on the World Happiness Report. All of them have long, long Christian backgrounds. All of them. Now, they're not Christian nations today, but they live with a Judeo-Christian ethic today. And my point is, that is not something that you get rid of, that you just kind of cast off to the side and say that's unimportant. Every single one of the top 20 are Judeo-Christian ethic nations. Good for Skyler. Skyler's looking it up. Say again?
Are they all forward
too? No, they're also... So you'll go in the good question. Go and look at the differentiators there. I won't go through all the report today, but you'll see where that question was kind of controlled for. Philosophically consistent, I'd say yeah. Acting as though love is the highest moral bar is perfectly consistent with the idea of a perfect being. Like we think of a perfect being who God ought to be, saying that He's all loving or it is all loving. That seems philosophically self-consistent. In fact, you might argue it's necessary. I would say it's necessary. So that's philosophically consistent because that's the ethic that the Bible propounds, is love God, number one. Number two is very close, love your neighbor as yourself. So love is this kind of ultimate ethic. That also seems to be what we intuitively think is the ultimate thing. We all want to be loved, and we want to love other people. We think that that's kind of a better world. Well, that matches up. That's not what atheism tells you. Atheism doesn't tell you that love's the best thing in the world. Atheism tells you a whole bunch of other things ought to be the case, but you can't really deduce love unless it's a biochemical reaction that's illusory. And if it's an illusion, it's not true. And if it's not true, I'm back in the matrix a little bit. Okay, how we can live longer? Well, this is an interesting one. This is one of the other reasons to try to figure out whether Christianity is true. Because if it's true, you can really actually maximize the living long thing, right? Living forever, it seems decent. Is it time-tested? Well, the idea is an ancient idea. How about verified by science? Now, I won't go through it here, but the minimal facts approach of looking at four basic facts. Jesus was, all the scholars agree on, atheist scholars, Christian scholars, conservative Christian scholars, liberal scholars. Jesus was crucified, everybody agrees. Jesus was buried, very probably in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. That's actually very well established, historically speaking. Three, that the disciples had what they reported as experiences with the risen Christ. Lots of disciples, but most importantly the 11 that were still left, had these reports. And that furthermore, they kind of went to their deaths about it. But the last is the origin of the Christian church. Now, there was a lot of messiahs around at the time. Some of them didn't make it. Some of them got killed. Some of them just petered out. Why did Christianity become as successful as it did? When you look at these four, and I'm not going to do it for us here, but when I looked at these four, the best explanation of this was actually that God raised Jesus from the dead to me. If you're not biased against that as a possible outcome, and especially if you've already done your philosophy and cosmology and you realize that there's good reason to believe there's a God out there. believing that this God might have raised Jesus from the dead is not that improbable. In fact, it seems to me to make some sense. So I actually think that way of looking, I don't have to treat the Bible like it's inspired. I don't have to even assume that it's true in its original form. I can just treat it like a history book and still come away with that conclusion. And if the conclusion is that God raised Jesus from the dead, well, now you've got something that you can deal with, and then go back and say, well, if we think that it was reliable and Jesus said these things, then those are going to carry more weight than if he was just a random rabbi or prophet, I think. Okay. Is it last origin of moral intuitions? Time-tested? Yes. Oldest of the moral explanations is that God's telling you what to do. Verified by experience? My experiences of morality fit most closely with the biblical articulations, not other ethics out there. Uniquely Christian positions, loving one's enemy. Picking a wife based on a biblical formula, that's how I picked my wife. Literally, not the one that I thought I would marry. Even when I was dating her, I was like, I'm not sure. I went to Proverbs and said, I'm going to go through this checklist, did. And people have called me a liar to my face for saying I've never had an argument with my wife. But people know my wife, and they can, if you don't believe them, you can ask. We've never had an argument. That's what happens, part of what can happen when you choose to these kinds of things biblically.
You said you argued with her over something.
When I say argue, yeah, so when I say argument, I don't mean an academic discussion, but I mean like what we all mean. That's a good point, because you got to call people on it when they don't make consistent statements. So by, I mean the Monty Python style of argument, the argument clinic. Is it philosophically consistent? Yes. By following the following argument. If God does not exist and objective morals, duties and obligations do not exist, moral duties and obligations do exist, therefore God exists. This is called the argument by contraposition. So it is philosophically consistent to say so. In fact, it seems to me to be the only explanation that matters. So when I measure Christian theism against the competition, I don't believe it because I grew up in it. I did happen to grow up in it, so I got at least an under-the-hood look at it initially. But I think it bears noting that my view of Christianity today is extremely different than the one that I held when I was a young man. And in fact, I might say the following. I have rejected much of the faith that I had as a kid as being improperly founded. And I was actually totally open, you'll have to believe me if you wish, to believe in something different. But I'm back to this because when I do the math on it, when I do the science on it, when I do the philosophy on it, Christianity appears very clearly, not just to eke out past the other ones. It is the runaway winner to me of all the viewpoints. I was supposed to get this done in 30 minutes. How did I do? The much more can and should be said about all the things that I talked about, but this is my jumping off point. I have a bunch of other arguments that I use. I have a bunch of other scientific evidence I like to appeal to, but at the end of the day, if you want to know why I believe in what I believe, that's the reason why. It just passes my own tests on the important questions, and it passes it with flying colors far and away better than any other viewpoint does, especially when you consider them as a whole and you ask about consistency through them, which to me makes a lot of sense.